order. It is 1:30 on Wednesday, January 24th. And present today are Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Vice Chair Guerra, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Gruen-Guttenberg.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Representative Thompson, myself, Chair Seaton. And Representative Gren will be joining us shortly. And we have Representative Ortiz joining us as well. So today we will hear department budget overviews from the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Administration. So Trustee Chair Mary Jane Michael and CEO Mike Abbott, would you please come to the table? Put you on the record. I just want to let people know that with three of these, we will have to end the mental health at 2:10 so that we can get all three in, and the cutoff for the next department, the Department of Revenue, will be at 2:50. So welcome. Would you go ahead and introduce yourselves for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Mary Jane Michael, and I'm the chair of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
My name is Mike Abbott. I'm the CEO of the trust.
I'd also like to take a moment to introduce our other trustees that are present today. Chris Cook, who's the vice chair. Lorraine Durr, who's the secretary. Paula Easley, and I'd just like to acknowledge Paula has served 11 years, and she'll be leaving the trust in March at the end of her term, but she's done an incredible job. Greg Jones. Greg has also served as the acting CEO and as a trustee, and he will be leaving in March, and he's been an incredible asset. Jerome Selby and Carlton Smith. We also have present with us today Vernay Berner and Mike Powers, both who have been appointed but have not yet been confirmed. As many of you are aware, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority was established to provide a perpetual trust to improve the lives of beneficiaries. We recognize today, given the current fiscal challenges of our state, that the landscape has changed. Today, we continue to partner with the state as we have in the past. However, once we were known for seeding new projects to foster best practices in the state through focus areas like Bring the Kids Home, a successful project that ultimately led to bringing children who had been placed out of state for treatment back home for care. But today we recognize our partnership and investment must include broader overall systems change in the state so that we can create a system that is both progressive and sustainable.
And before you go further, I want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Tilton, and also I forgot to remind people about their cell phones. If you'd silence those, please. Thank you. Go ahead.
We believe our substantial investment in Medicaid reform and expansion and criminal justice reinvestment are two such efforts. This past year was also a time of internal organizational change. Hiring a new CEO after the departure of our longtime executive director, Jeff Jesse, who served as an icon for the organization since its inception. And I'm happy to report after an extensive search, we now have Mike as our new CEO. We also looked internally at our governance structure and operating procedures and ultimately hired an organizational management consultant, Catherine Wood, with Raven Management Consultants, who worked with the trustees and staff to help us navigate the challenges of organizational change. Over several months, we updated our bylaws, created committee charters, and much more. Some of our documents we modeled after the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We engaged stakeholders and the statutory advisory boards in the process. I believe the time was well spent to take pause and get our house in order. We have a good foundation for moving forward. Going into 2018, I want to say how proud I am of the incredibly talented and committed group of trustees and staff at the trust, and I want to report that the organization is both financially and organizationally healthy. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mike for the remainder of the presentation.
Mr. Chairman, as I said earlier, my name is Mike Abbott. I'm the recently hired CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. It's a pleasure to be here today. So without further ado, I'll move into a quick description of our revenue situation. In FY19, the trust will be able to deploy $29.5 million for mental health trust beneficiaries. The bulk of that, a little over $21 million, comes from the payout associated with our invested resources. We have about $550 million under investment right now, about $500 million of that with the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, and another $50 million managed by the Department of Revenue. We take a four-year average payout of 4.25% from the value of those investments, and that's what has generated that $21 million number there you see at the top of the page. In addition, we take a four-year average of the lapsed funds, the funds that are authorized for expenditure but not fully expended during a given year. That generates another $3 million of revenue available in FY19. And then we similarly take another four-year average of the spendable income generated by the Trust Land Office through the management of trust lands. Those are the three main revenue streams that generate our spendable income in any year, and that's how we get to 29.5. As you can see from the table at the bottom of the slide, that represents a general upward progression of 1 to 4% per year. We're obviously subject to a variety of factors, investment returns in particular, but for the most part, we are on an upward trend. I think we are have no reason to believe that trend's not going to continue, certainly for the next few years, and I hope we'll be able to show you next year at this time anticipated available funding that exceeds $30 million. I mentioned approximately $5 million of spendable income in FY19 associated with the Trust Land Office activity. Here's a good snapshot of the history of Trust Land Office revenue generating. As you can see, there's a lot of volatility in this revenue stream. This represents the activity associated, and it's a busy slide, and I won't ask you to try to interpret all pieces of it, but there's a sliver in there for minerals, another one for oil and gas, one for lands activity, one for timber, and then one for our real estate portfolio. So typically, those five categories make up the revenue that we spend. Not all of that is spendable. I'm careful to add that term because under the terms of our settlement and the statutes that implemented it, certain types of Trust Land Office revenues are invested and are required to be invested for the permanent benefit of our beneficiaries. And this slide shows bars of the same height, so the same same dollar values in each year, but instead of dividing it up by the resource sector, it divides it from spendable versus investable. And as you can see, in most years, the value of our investable revenues exceeds that of our spendable. So. And I'd be glad to clarify, I know there's been a lot of discussion on the differences between that, and I won't belabor that at this time, but this is the one of the core elements that we'll be talking about as we discuss the ongoing legislative audit and the outcome of that. So beyond our revenue picture, now there's our spending plan. I think all of you are aware, as Mary Jane indicated, that the trust exists as a result of a settlement almost 25 years ago. The trust funds can only be spent for purposes that the trustees authorize. However, several of those categories of spending require legislative approval in addition to trustee approval. And so this slide sort of divides our proposed spending into the three big categories. The dark blue category are what we call authority grants. That's about $10 million. And those are the funds that we expend, that we allocate to third-party providers. These are to nonprofits, tribal organizations, local governments, et cetera, that are providing a combination of system improvements and direct services to beneficiaries. That makes up a little more than a third of our spending. Another rough third, a little more than a third, is what we call MTAR money. I apologize for the acronym. If I can think of a better one before next year, you'll get it then. That's almost $11 million. And those are funds that are allocated by the trustees to be used by state agencies. So in this area, the legislature does have a role. The state agencies obviously need appropriation authority to accept the trust's funds. And you'll see that in the form of program receipt authority or other similar designations inside agency budgets. And there's several of those agency budgets, many of them. And I know you're starting the budget overview process. I'm sure that'll be highlighted for you during those conversations. But that's roughly $11 million of our proposed FY19 spending. And then the last and smallest category is a little over $8.5 million for the trust's administrative expenses. And this is the combination of the trust authority office and the trust land office. The trust land office is located in the DNR. The trust land office employees are DNR employees, and their funding is appropriated inside the DNR budget. The trust authority team, another team of approximately 20 employees, lives inside the Department of Revenue budget. So you'll see that in two different places as you consider operating budget, and we'll talk a little bit more about our operating budget in a few minutes. Next, I wanted to highlight where that money is going and to what end. So the trustees' funding is associated with these six areas of emphasis. The first two are what we call strategic initiatives. There are certainly projects that you are well aware of. Medicaid reform and expansion. As you all are aware, the trust committed a little more than $10 million in a multi-year program to support the state's effort to expand and then reform Medicaid. That work is well underway right now, and I know you'll be talking to the Department of Health and Social Services about the status of that. I think it's clear that the trust has been the key investor in that reform and expansion opportunity. And we got briefed earlier today from Commissioner Davidson. Sounds like about 40,000 additional Alaskans are served with Medicaid than had been served prior to expansion, and a significant number of those new Medicaid beneficiaries are trust beneficiaries, and more than $50 million has been expended on behavioral health work through Medicaid since expansion took place. So that, again, is a significant improvement in the lives of our beneficiaries and speaks to the trust's interest in both Medicaid expansion and Medicaid reform. Our other big strategic initiative is criminal justice reform and reinvestment. Again, you all are well aware of what that entails. The trust is a key investor in that because, again, trust beneficiaries are overrepresented statistically inside the population within the Department of Corrections and the other elements of the criminal justice system. So we are very supportive of the efforts initiated with SB 91 and modified by SB 54, and we continue to be committed to that, and we continue to make multi-million-dollar per year investments in system improvements associated with criminal justice reform and reinvestment. And then our focus areas are ones that you've seen before: disability justice, substance abuse prevention and treatment, beneficiary employment and engagement, housing and long-term services and supports. These are longstanding trust areas of emphasis and areas where we have invested significantly over the years. And there are many crossovers between and amongst the focus areas and these strategic initiatives. This slide is virtually identical to the slide you would have seen last year in this presentation. Many of you are aware, I think, that the trust is required to conduct two-year budgeting. So we are in this, FY19 is the second of a two-year budget cycle for us. So the priorities that were established and initiated with FY18 are continuing into FY19. So we will begin our planning for another two-year budget cycle that'll encompass FY20 and 21. That'll start this spring, conclude this summer, and you'll see the product of that a year from now. And so there may be some difference in our priorities and areas of emphasis at that time, but what you're seeing now is the culmination of a two-year budgeting process. And so that's why we haven't had to make a lot of modifications in this slide since we talked to you last year. Our operating budget recommendations for the state, typically, this is, I went back and I watched the tape of the last several presentations to the House Finance Committee, and of course it was Jeff Jesse doing that in those days. I talked to Jeff briefly before that. He gave me a number of tips about how to work with all of you, so don't think that Jeff's not still in the room. We'll be trying to channel him extensively going forward. I very much enjoy his support. But this is the slide when Jeff would typically sort of scold the administration and encourage the Finance Committee and the legislature generally to ignore or change many of the governor's recommendations and instead support trustee recommendations. This year, that's really not the case. We're happy to be able to report that the governor's proposed budget for mental health GF is almost identical to what the trustees recommended. The one significant exception to that, of course, is the governor's initiative to recommend an $18 million supplemental appropriation, sort of a capital style appropriation for a multi-year commitment for substance abuse and disorder services. So we did not recommend that. We very much support it. If we'd have thought of it, we might have recommended it, but we can't suggest that that was our idea before it started. But generally, throughout most of the department budgets, the GFMH component is essentially what the trustees would recommend. So I'm grateful to be able to report that to you, that we're not going to be asking you for a lot of big changes in the governor's proposal regarding GFMH and the operating budget. Capital budget is slightly different. Still a lot of consistency between what the governor recommended and what the trustees recommended. One significant difference is that we had hoped that the governor's budget would include a significant increase in the amount of state funds associated with housing and homelessness, specifically the Homeless Assistance Project and special needs grants. There is some money in the governor's budget. It's essentially flat funded from prior years, for several prior years. We believe that an increment of approximately $5 million is worthy and in the best interest of the state at this time. We are increasingly aware at the trust, and I think generally in throughout Alaska, that increasing access to housing and is critical to reducing the cost of other state services. We have learned what I think many people knew themselves individually, but there is now good data to suggest that folks that are dealing with a number of different challenges don't deal with those challenges as long as they are not housed. Until they have housing that they can rely on and that they can count on and that they feel safe in and some level of comfort, they don't deal with addiction issues, and they don't deal with job issues, and they don't deal with education or family support. It is increasingly evident, and there is evidence from Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau in particular, that permanent supportive housing makes a difference. And funding of this scale, we believe, would make a big difference for the state in two primary areas. One, the increase in the number of permanent supportive housing facilities and or an increase in what's called rapid rehousing funding. Those are two very different. One is more of a brick-and-mortar approach and would support the actual development of either the conversion of existing facilities or the development of new ones. The other is in the form of rent support and other renter supports to keep people housed, that are, and that typically involves working inside the market, the sort of the market-based sector of rentals. So both of those programs work. We know that from evidence in Alaska, primarily in Anchorage, Juneau, and Fairbanks, but in other communities as well. Be glad to share that data with the committee at your convenience, and there's others that can speak to it more eloquently and in more detail than I can. But we believe that this would pay for itself in a reduction of other state expenses going forward. So anyway, that's on your radar screen, and we welcome the opportunity to talk to the committee at your convenience further about that. And I say that knowing that capital budget is a tough subject these days, and we're under no illusion that somehow there's a lot of money available for this and other worthy programs. But we do believe, and the trust is putting a lot of its own money where its mouth is on this as well. We are ourselves engaged in the development of and the fostering of permanent supportive housing as well. The one area where we have a substantive disagreement with the governor's proposal has to do with the trust's administrative budgets. I mentioned earlier that the trust authority within the Department of Revenue and the Trust Land Office within the Department of Natural Resources require dedicated appropriations. Mind you, it's all trust funds that we're talking about. These are self-funded administrative expenses, but they do require direct appropriation from the legislature. The trustees recommended an administrative budget of approximately $8.7 million. The governor proposed a little less than $8.1 million. The governor's budget essentially flat funds both the TLO office and the TAO office at their FY18 authorized levels. That's going to affect our ability to, number one, make smart decisions as we deploy our resources, and number two, manage our lands and other assets to gain maximum value from them. There will be an impact on our capability to do both of those projects, a marginal impact, but an impact nonetheless. And again, I stress that we are recommending, the funds that we're recommending be authorized are mental health trust funds and cannot be used for for another general government or other function. So if our budgets did not match our requests, those funds would simply roll back and be available in future years for other trust purposes. So it would not assist you or others in solving other non-mental health related challenges. So the last topic in our presentation today was our legislative priorities. First on this list, and these aren't in any specific order, first on them is to what we call protect criminal justice reform. The trust was an ardent, full-throated advocate for SB 91 a couple of years ago, and supported most, if not all, of the modifications in SB 54. We are, as I mentioned before, trust beneficiaries are overrepresented in the criminal justice process, whether it's in the corrections or other elements, and so it is a key trust initiative to make sure that those beneficiaries get access to the care and support that they need to address their challenges. And we believe that criminal justice reform is a very effective way of doing that. I know that the legislature has access to a recent University of Alaska product that has begun to measure the impact of criminal justice reform, 10 key elements of so-called CJR, and found that eight of those 10 are already bearing fruit in terms of reducing criminal activity and state cost. That project, that measurement project, if you will, was funded by the trust. That has been one of our key elements of participation in criminal justice reform, is to assist the state generally in understanding the impact of those changes on both criminal activity, recidivism, and state dollars. And we will continue to invest in those analytics so that you and others have a chance to make informed choices as we move forward. And we believe that the choices the legislature made over the last couple of years have been positive and are serving the state well. Another project that we'll be supporting this year is SB 76, Senator Michicki's bill to address Title IV revisions. That's code for alcohol law. SB 76 represents a cooperative effort between the alcohol industry and a variety of other stakeholders to address, I think, what are deemed to be sort of long-needed updates to Title IV. This is not a tax bill. It's not that there aren't folks that want to talk about taxes for or against them. This legislation is not that. So this is essentially, some folks have called it a cleanup of Title IV. We know this is not before the House at this time, certainly not before the House Finance Committee. We hope it will be eventually, and you should expect to hear the trust as an advocate at that time. And then the last issue on our list and the last issue for the committee today, trust investment legislation. I mentioned before that there's been questions asked, valid questions, I think, about the trust's activity over the last 5 to 8 years regarding the investments that the trust has made using that investable revenue stream. There's a special legislative audit underway right now. Many of you, I know, through your service on LBNA are aware of this. That was initiated in December of 2016. I think when it was initiated, it was targeted to be completed in November or December of 2017. That has not been possible. LBNA is almost done. In fact, we will begin to get their preliminary, we'll get sort of their exit interview or their preliminary findings in the next week or two. I believe it is likely, based on conversations with Ms. Curtis, I believe it is her expectation that it'll get to the legislature in March. I think there's been an expectation that at the end of that process that it would be appropriate for the legislature then to consider those findings and then consider legislation to clarify the trust's authorities going forward. Unfortunately, if the findings aren't available to the legislature until March, that creates a timing challenge. And so the trustees have authorized us to move forward, and we've begun conversations with legislators to consider beginning a legislative conversation now, starting, if you will, a bill now, and then having it informed by the results of the legislative audit in a month or so. There's no expectation that a bill would be completed before the audit was before you, but we can at least start the process. We think we have a good understanding of the issues that will require clarification, so we're working with legislators to begin the development of such a bill and hope to bring that to you as it moves its way through the legislative process. So we're eager to get the results of the audit. In an ideal world, we'd have all had it for 30, maybe 60 days by now, and that would inform the beginning of a legislative process. Just because of timing, I don't think that's going to be possible, so we're hoping to start the consideration now and then meet the audit halfway. And that's what we're moving forward on right now. And, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for your patience and your attention, and we'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Sure, and we have Representative Ortiz. Before that starts, I wanted to ask, on the second to last page, the total difference in the budgets the 623. What does that mostly come from? Is that healthcare escalations that have to be absorbed in the budget, or what is that just program?
Two things. First, the last year, our administrative budgets were short-funded, and so it represents an effort to reclaim that, and then also to address a couple of increases. Two areas, generally, in the area of the Trust Land Office, we anticipate an aggressive year in processing both the Southeast Land Exchange and continuing the development of mineral projects, primarily a large project that we're hopeful of in the Icy Cape region on the Gulf of Alaska. The combination of that work at the TLO will require additional funds. At the Trust Authority Office, we're continuing to try to do the best job possible, number one, to deploy our resources usefully, and number two, understand the impact of those resources. And instead of simply fund and forget, we are trying to shift to, and we have begun to shift to, a fund and measure approach. And in coming years, and even now, we can begin to talk to the committee at your convenience about our efforts in that area. So it'll make a personnel impact and a contract services impact.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz, Representative Wilson, Representative Grant, and by the way, I forgot to recognize that Representative Grant had joined us some time ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to page 9 of your presentation, you are requesting a $5.3 million increase to help address the housing and homelessness crisis. If, in fact, those monies are appropriated or expended, what might that look like in terms of how that $5.3 million, in summary, how would that be used? Like, would it be filtered down to communities for different projects to address those issues? Is that how it kind of works?
Yes. These would fund community-based grants that would be allocated on a merit process, typically in concert with AHFC, and for a variety of permanent supportive housing options. And I mentioned rapid rehousing and brick and mortar as two potential grant types, but there may be others as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, and Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you have 40,000 more recipients between Medicaid and Medicaid expansion. Do you have any idea how many more services are now available to that 40,000 when it comes to whether substance abuse or behavioral health?
There's 40,000 Alaskans that are served. A significant percentage of them are our beneficiaries. Short answer is no. I do not have a way to quantify that. I do know, according to the commissioner, that there's been since expansion was authorized, or since it moved forward, that approximately an additional $50 million in claims for behavioral health have been funded. So I don't know what the total amount of new money associated with expansion has been, so I don't have a percentage for how much of that has been behavioral health. But that's a lot of additional behavioral health services, and we're grateful that our beneficiaries are getting the benefit of that.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman? Just one.
Really quick, because we've got only 8 minutes.
Well, I had to figure out the first one. Okay, so the Department of Corrections is looking at the possibility of opening up Palmer as an institution. There's been some talk about whether it would make more sense to make it more into a nonprofit that would be able to take care of behavioral health such or substance abuse and be covered more under Medicaid or Medicaid expansion and getting the service that you need. Have you ever had any of those types of conversations, or will you, with the Department of Corrections? I would rather see a treatment facility so that we don't just incarcerate, but we actually have treatment going.
We have a strong ongoing relationship with DOC and expect that to continue. I'm not aware of a specific proposal for trust funding or participation in a project like that, but if there was one, we would be glad to entertain it.
Thank you.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Abbott, apologize for not being here for the most part of doing a bill hearing, but thank you for coming. I appreciate you guys' update. On the last slide, which I did get to hear, You mentioned on the criminal justice reform there is, I think you said 8 of the 10 maybe benchmarks within a report, something like that?
8 of 10 pieces of criminal justice reform. As you know, CJR is a broad term of which there are several different elements. And so it's my understanding that this effort that I'm referring to measured outcomes associated with 10, and 8 of those showed positive results. And I'd be glad to make that information available to you.
And that's what I was going to ask. If that report could be sent around to us, I'd greatly appreciate it.
And if you'd send that to the House Financial Distribute Hall.
Happy to do so.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg. Oh, wait a minute. Garrett and then Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Abbott, welcome. I'm very sympathetic to the homelessness grant for the capital budget. That'll be done later in the budget cycle. But can you please, I would hope that you would outline for the members of at least this committee how that money would be used effectively. I know in Anchorage there's a lot of low-cost, below-market housing available, I've been told, but that would be useful, very useful, if we're going to consider that. You have the four-year, $18 million behavioral health program that's included in the governor's budget. I guess that's not your issue, but that seems like a capital grant to me. It's a four-year program. I don't know why it's in the operating budget.
I think both of those things are true.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Abbott, I think need some clarification on some of the larger issues. What effect did the increasing expanding Medicaid expansion have on your budget? What do you not pay for anymore that you could have? And I'll ask you the next question is, how does the $18 million increase in the governor's mental health impact your two-year budget?
Since the trust does not fund very much direct service to beneficiaries, we facilitate services, we help organize and get services started. Medicaid expansion is not a significant reduction in what trust funding would be. In regards to the $18 million, the governor's proposed that's essentially a supplemental request of GFMH and would not necessarily affect our budget either. Okay. So he's not trying to spend trust dollars with that money.
Thank you. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Abbott, welcome, and thank you for being here. A large amount of the budget that goes out into grants that go out into the community and nonprofit providers and what have you. I'm just wondering, are you applying some sort of metrics to determine the success of effects of the dollars that are being spent out on those grants?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, ma'am. We have an aggressive evaluation process associated with our grants. And we'd be glad to share with the committee some of the products that we produce ourselves that help guide staff and ultimately trustee decision making related to those choices.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. And I had a question. I talked to Mr. Jesse before about it. On your slide, and hopefully in the future you'll number them so we can refer back to them more easily, but on the current priorities, you have substance abuse prevention and treatment. It seems like that we've kind of hit this roadblock of having a number of ways in which we can have prevention mean that you don't acquire new beneficiaries, but there has been some question about the mental health trust authority being able to use any of its money to prevent acquiring new beneficiaries. A lot cheaper in the end, but I wanted to know how you are going to direct forward to trying to lower the number of beneficiaries, which, although it may not be exactly the goal, treatment may be the goal for the entire state and the health of the population. It seems like that should be the goal. Can you address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, and to the extent that at one point the trust was reluctant to fund prevention-related activities, that time has passed. We are funding prevention activities. Now, we do expect that prevention activities that we would be able to show a very direct linkage between prevention and what's going and the behavior we're trying to preclude or reduce. There's a lot of so-called indirect prevention-related activity that we may not be able to participate in. But we do fund targeted prevention activities in several associated with several of our beneficiary categories, and I expect that to continue.
Okay, thank you. And let's see, I guess we are out of time. So thank you very much, appreciate it. And if members have questions for the trust, that are individual, you can, I'm sure, we can get hold of, send them to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, next up will be the Department of Revenue.
She thinks they can absorb some of those.
I mean, these overviews will take 2 hours.
Thank you.
Take a brief at ease. Call the meeting back to order. And we have the Department of Revenue. Welcome, Commissioner. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you. My name is Sheldon Fisher. I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Administration, or Department of Revenue, forgive me. I'm getting confused.
And for the record, my name is Michelle Ville. I'm the Acting Admin Services Director.
Shall we begin? Great. So appreciate being here. We'll try to move quickly. Hopefully our budget isn't too complicated.
And just for the committee's information, again, at 2:50, we'll have to cut this conversation.
Great. I think just at a very high level, within the department, there are a number of other organizations that we help administer the budget for, but the department has four primary divisions. There's the tax division, which largely collects and administers our tax policy and our revenue policy. They also do some work in terms of regulating charitable gaming and provide a estimation function for the state. There's the Treasury Division, which largely is a cash management, debt management, and investment management function for the state. They also manage our unclaimed property division. Is it not working?
It's working too well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Then there's the permanent fund division, permanent fund dividend division, for those that may be listening, this should be distinguished between the Permanent Fund Corporation. The division within the Department of Revenue distributes the permanent fund. They ensure eligibility and manage that process for the state. And then finally, there's the Child Support Services Division, which helps collect and distribute child support payments for parents in the state of Alaska. In addition to that, there are a number of corporations and boards that we help support, and most of these I believe you'll be hearing from independently, so I don't intend to spend a lot of time, but of course there's the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Permanent Fund Corporation, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, the Mental Health Trust Authority that was just here, and then the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority. Our budget. This is the general fund portion of our budget, and it shows both the total budget as well as the comparison of how this compares to other agency budgets as a whole. As you can see, our budget is declining both in terms of absolute dollars as well as in terms of the percentage of total agency operations. In the current period for fiscal year 19 compared to fiscal year 18, the budget will decline by about $640,000. Most of that is associated with the Treasury Division. There's about $525,000 that reflects a shift in allocation from our department, from the Treasury budget to the Armed Board budget. This is largely associated with a decline in state assets and therefore a reallocation of the cost of managing those assets and shifting that towards the Armed Board. There's also a reduction in the child support and services budget. Overall, their budget went down by about $425,000. Only about $145,000 of that was associated, was state GF. The other was federal funding for that program. And then there was an increase in the mental health budget by about $31,000 in connection with the long-term care ombudsman function there. This shows the entire budget for all of the departments and the associated organizations broken down by category. I'll spend just a minute. The grant portion is all associated with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and its federal housing assistance payments. The red portion, which represents services, is largely the cost of that the state spends to manage our assets. And so that includes both the Permanent Fund Corporation as well as the Alaska Retirement Management Board. These, as you can see, these costs are growing, and that actually is a positive thing because it means our assets are growing, and so we're spending more to manage a larger set of assets. You'll also see that our services, personal services, are growing. That's the blue line at the very bottom, and that, again, actually is also a good thing because what that reflects is an effort by both the Permanent Fund and the Armed, well, in this case, largely the Permanent Fund, but it's been a strategic direction by both the Permanent Fund and the Armed Board to bring more asset management in-house and manage that with local talent and local individuals. And so rather than paying someone in New York or Los Angeles to manage our money, we're hiring people here in Juneau to do that work at a much reduced fee compared to what we would pay someone else. This is a different view. It's the same information that essentially we saw before. It's just broken out and showing a view over time. And so the blue line at the top shows the taxation and treasury functions. That's the tax group and the treasury group. And you can see that between 15 and 16, there was a fairly substantial decline, and then a more level declining but at a lower rate over the last few years. That was a combination of reduction in the 15 to 16 period was a reduction in positions in the tax group, as well as changes in terms of how we manage the CBR account. And then the other groups, I'm happy to discuss. It's the same information, but you can see generally declining budgets over the last few years. I'm on slide 7 now, this is a similar view to what we saw before, but again, broken down by different components. And so the top line there is the permanent fund, and again, just to reiterate, most of that growth is associated with growth in the permanent fund. Well, essentially, all of that is associated with the growth in the assets of the permanent fund. Most of it is for external managers. You can see pretty flat budgets for the rest of the group of companies. Alaska HFC has a modest decrease, and you can see kind of a flat budget the rest of the way.
And thank you for the presentation of both GF only and all funds.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, you explained regarding the Permanent Fund Corporation increase on page 6 or slide 6. The Mental Health Trust Authority, could you just briefly touch on that sharp increase over the last several years, just from my notes?
So thank you. You're really referring to from 14 to 15, that increase from $410,000 to $900,000. And so that is associated. There was a $500,000 increase to the Mental Health Trust associated with the Fetal Alcohol Syndrome media campaign to try to bring awareness to that. And so that is largely, and that's been consistent, so that's largely what that jump is about.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Chairman, at your taxation and treasury line, if you go from 15 down to 19, you see some significant reductions there. Is that a reflection of reduction in auditing staff, and/or is there more to it than that?
Through the chair, so there's two issues. This has largely been a result of the division implemented a new financial system that allowed us to automate many things that had been done manually prior to that. And so we have reduced, I believe, 19 positions. Is that right? So we reduced, in that period, we reduced 19 positions. I believe most of that was through attrition. There were a few people that were laid off, but most of it was through attrition.
Follow-up? And with those reductions, have we seen a decreased ability for the auditing staff to keep up with their responsibilities in relationship to oil and tax stuff?
Through the chair, I don't think we've seen a decline in our ability to keep up with that. This is a topic that we are having discussions around because there is a fairly significant delay in completing our audits, and so that's something that we're having internal discussions around. How do we accelerate that process? How do we get back on track? But I don't understand that to be attributable to this reduction. I think this reduction was more maintain the status quo, really didn't hurt or help that larger issue.
Thank you.
I'm going to move on from page 7 unless there are questions. If you look on page 8, 9, and 10, they're the same information for each of the various divisions and entities that we work with. I'm happy to. I didn't think I would spend time and go through each division, but we're happy to do that if that would be helpful. I thought I would call attention to a couple of data points on this chart. The first is you can see the number of positions, and I'm on page 8 and take the first line, the tax division. There are 107 positions, 91 of them were filled. This was as of December 15th. Since then, we actually have been able to fill a number more of those. Each kind of position and division is its own story, but I think that in general, much of the work that the division and the department does is fairly technical, and so our MQs, our minimum qualifications, actually tend to be require a fairly high level of skill, and sometimes we do struggle to fill positions. But we are working on that working to try to get these organizations fully staffed. And that's true certainly with the tax division. The treasury division is another one that has – these are investment officers by and large, and we have recently hired three, I believe, and so that gap is narrowed a little bit. The other column that I would call your attention to is the effectiveness rating. There's five kind of categories, rank going from exceptional to highly effective to effective to moderately effective to low effectiveness. I think that this is something I feel passionately about in terms of establishing standards and measuring our performance against those standards, and so in the coming year you'll be hearing more about that from us, and as we work to try to build a tighter integration between a set of performance measurements and our success against those performance measurements. To a large extent, that's the presentation. Again, I'm happy to dig in, and maybe I went too quickly, but if there are questions or concerns or items that people would like to discuss, I'm happy to engage.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me get back to it. On slide 6, the mental health budget, the increases in – I'm sorry. Is that – I mean, you were talking about the FAS campaign as those increases. Is that operating instead of capital because that's the way mental health budgets their programs? Or it would seem like that would be a capital instead of an operating expense.
Through the chair, I may not have enough information to answer that precisely. It seems to me that this was a media campaign as opposed to standing up a program or something like that. So intuitively, not knowing a lot more detail, it does seem like that operation is the right place to put an ongoing expense to inform the public about the dangers and the need to take care for that. But I've got to confess, I may not be the best person to respond to that question.
We'll get back.
Reverend Guerra?
No, thanks. You're just used to it.
No, I saw the hand go like this. Fine. So one question on tax auditors.
Yes.
We had approved a couple, and we didn't see it in the governor's budget, the additional amount. That was reduced 25% because they couldn't be hired for at least a quarter of the year, and then seems there was some interpretation that was not fully was not funding to it tax auditors last year, although they would only be three-quarter of the year, so it was three-quarter of money. That expectation was that they would be fully funded this year. Is the Department of Revenue going to bring those two tax auditors on?
Through the chair, and Michelle will correct me, those auditors have been hired, and they're performing, and you're right, we didn't increase the budget. We just concluded that we would need to absorb that 25%, but they're on board, and we'll continue to use them and deploy them in the division.
And does the department have any policy for maintaining positions open for 60 or 90 days so that there's money available to fund those positions? How are you gaining those funds? We've had some departments that have a policy of maintaining a 90-day window before they can actually replace core staff because they need to be able to have that GF to shift to fund other things that have been reduced.
So as you can see, I'm on slide 8. When you look at the tax division, the gap is closed a little bit, but you've got about 16 positions vacant, the difference between 107 and 91. And that's obviously higher than our vacancy factor. So we are experiencing a greater vacancy factor than what may be in the budget. It's less by design and more by just the challenge of filling these positions, which are relatively technical. And so to be honest with you, Chairman, I would need to get back to confirm whether that's exactly the strategy or where the funding's going to come to fund those positions. But the tax division has felt like they can manage within the budget they have.
And I'm talking about the department overall or any of the divisions.
Excuse me.
If any of the divisions have, whether it's child support or anything else, a policy, whether it's written or generalized policy to maintain vacancies for a certain duration to allow you to have the unrestricted general funds to do some of these other things, we'd like to know about it. And the subcommittees, just be prepared for that question in the subcommittees. We can't go into it all here.
Great. Well, I will be prepared for the subcommittee this afternoon. But the short answer is we do not have a stated policy in any of the divisions in terms of delaying hiring or trying to have a vacancy factor above the budgeted factor.
And Representative Kawasaki.
I have a question actually for you, Mr. Chairman. Are we going to hear from AHFC, which is an agency under revenue? We won't. Okay. Then I'll try and direct my question to the commissioner.
Okay, yeah.
Commissioner, there's a handful of capital budget requests, and they're funded through UGF directly from AHFC dividends. One of them's the homeless assistance program. The other one's the rental assistance for victims empowering choice program. The Mental Health Trust just mentioned that they'd like to see a $5.3 million in additional funds for housing. In the Department of Health and Social Services, substance use disorders grant funding for the Public Safety Action Plan. There's also $3 million for local infrastructure, $4.5 million for residential, and $1.5 million for housing assistance. And I'm just trying to wrap my head around how those work together, And if you can get back to me on that, that's fine. Because they're also in different agencies.
Through the chair, thank you. We'll try to pull something together and get back a description to you. I'm not prepared to answer that now. Thank you.
Further questions for revenue? Seeing none, then thank you very much for the presentation, and we will see you in subsequent.
Great.
So we'll take a brief and ease while we spool up for the next presentation. Welcome back to order, and welcome. Would you go ahead and put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation? If they're both of you speaking, please say your first name when you're switching back and forth between two female voices.
We sound the same. I know. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Leslie Rydell. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration, and thank you for allowing us to be here today. With me here is Sherry Lowenstein. She's our admin services director. I've been the commissioner for about 3 months now, so she's very much my lifeline for things that you ask me that I don't know about. She's our lifeline for us. First slide. The mission of the Department of Administration is to provide consistent and efficient services to other state agencies. But as you know, we've gotten other duties over the years. Go ahead. Thanks. Where we also not only serve our departments, but we serve the public, and you can tell by the different colors. The green squares are the inside government services that we provide. The blue ones are the public services that we provide, DMV, public advocacy, and public defenders. And then the gray are some boards and commissions that we administer for the state. We don't do a lot with them other than do their administrative work. We have some new people since the last presentation that you saw, obviously me. Sheldon Fisher was here before. And Sylvan Robb is the new deputy commissioner. She took my place. We have a new Office of Information Technology, a CIO, which is Bill Vita. Division of Finance is now run by Kelly O'Sullivan. Office of Public Advocacy is Chad Holt. He was the deputy before. Now he's the director. Over in public broadcasting, Molly Cabler, and then in Oil and Gas Commission, Hollis French is now the chair for 4 years. He'll be the chair for 4 years. And I'm going to turn it over to Sherry Lowenstein to go over the next part.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sherry Lowenstein, the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Administration. The next four slides are provided by Legislative Finance. I'll give you a brief overview of the funding changes here. The first slide is comprised of undesignated general funds and designated general funds. You'll see in 15 is the peak where we spent were appropriated the most general fund in DGF. That amounted to $111 million. The next few years, 3 years, we steadily declined in that amount. This is in 19 budget. You'll see we have a $1 million request in retirement benefits, and we have another $1 million in OPA, Office of Public Advocacy. We'll discuss those a little bit later, but that's the result of the increase in FY19. The next slide,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
I'm sorry, I just couldn't hear the million dollars. You kind of dropped it off on OPA was because of what?
Through the chair. That is to provide more public guardians and one guardian ad litem, but we will discuss that increment a little bit further.
I think I just couldn't hear the end.
The next slide is represented by how your money is appropriated by the expenditure type. In this case, in Department of Administration, we're a service-oriented agency. We provide services to other agencies. We're heavy in the personal services line and the services line, providing contracts to help back up the services that we provide. The next slide is our, again, undesignated general funds and general funds. When we combine both the UGF and the DGF, you'll see Open PD have the lion's share at 50%. When you're looking at just undesignated general funds, they have about 60% of our budget. Motor vehicles is the second. They are receipt-driven 100%. They over-collect, and they actually turn money back to the general fund annually. And in central admin, the third highest user of these fund sources, we have four of our highest users. One is Division of Finance, which provides our statewide accounting services. Personnel, which provides statewide HR work. We have Retirement and Benefits, which is the healthcare division, and HPA Health Plans Administration, which is also related to healthcare. Those are all contained in the central admin, along with several other components. Next slide. The next slide represents all funds. In this case, in the Department of Administration, 31% of our funding sources are undesignated general funds and designated general funds, and 69% is other funds. That's because we're service-oriented. All of our interagency receipts are classified as other, and that's the mechanism that we use to bill other agencies. Again, in central admin, they're the next highest user. They're the highest user. Shared services and Office of Information Technology. If you look at 18 and 19, you'll see increases there. I would anticipate that will continue to go up as we move positions into our department to provide these services, and you'll see reductions of PCNs in other state agencies. The last slide that we provided is just a chart to show our UGF and DGF by our agencies. It's just in chart order, so it's a little more clear. You'll see as always, Office of Public Advocacy and Public Defender are our biggest users of these funding sources. The one item on this chart that I will just call out is the SATS and ALMR and the OIT/ETS. In 09, they were combined as one unit. In 16, they've been split out, and all of the general funds are shown in SATS and ALMR, but in that year, the OIT/ETS had just under $1.7 million in cuts in general funds. We, in all of our agencies that provide services to the departments, we have continued to find efficiencies and reduce our general funds without raising our rates to them. And I think that's the next slide.
On these slides for our different divisions, I'll go through and say a couple highlights. If you want me to go faster or slower, let me know, please. The Division of Finance, as you know, we launched IRIS, which is the Integrated Resources Information System, or basically our state accounting system. We call it IRIS. About 2 years ago, it's still moving along well and still getting the implementations going well. Implementation. Last year, we implemented the Human Resource Management Tool, which also went well, and we're doing more with that this year as well. Personnel and labor relations, that's where we do all the personnel and labor relations, obviously, and we're negotiating 7 contracts this year. So a large part of our public employees are in negotiations with us right now. One highlight is we had advertised for quite a while for an ADA coordinator and finally got a new one hired, so we're pleased about that. When you're talking about a vacancy factor, I heard you asking Commissioner Fisher, we don't have a policy in our department to keep vacancies any certain amount of time, but you might have seen this is an example where this one was vacant for quite a while, but we were trying to fill it, and it just took us a while to find the right person. So that's one of those kinds of examples.
Just want to make sure that people online know that we're on slide 11.
Oh, okay, sorry. I'll mention that too. Thank you. Slide 12, actually. Division of Retirement and Benefits, there's a couple things here that are new. So there's a $250,000 appropriation that will be used for an effort to discuss health care in Alaska, not just state employee health care, but health care in Alaska. There are several legislators involved in this effort, providers, insurers, Department of Administration, Health and Human Services, and also a Division of Insurance is involved in it as well. And so that's it's a AK reform group, and we hope to have a blueprint on healthcare in Alaska by the end of the year. The $750 is for the continued evaluation of the consolidation of healthcare costs, and that would be more about state employees and poly subs and school districts specifically. There's also a 3.75 million. That's for EGWIP, the implementation of EGWIP. And what EGWIP is the employer group waiver plan. It's a different way for us to get reimbursed by the federal government for our pharmacy, for our retiree healthcare plan. And so currently we do a plan where we get reimbursed at the end of usage. We get about $20 million last year for that. EGWIP turns it around and reimburses us as we go along, but we also pay to participate. It's a federal reimbursement, but we can get anywhere from $40 to $60 million in reimbursement with this plan. So we're moving to implement that in January of 2019.
And before we go on, Health Plans Administration, zero employees, that's can you just explain that a little more?
For the record, Sherry Lowenstein. The Health Plans Administration is where the administrative fee is paid to our third-party administrator right now. That's Aetna. And this 3.7 represents the increase to manage the Medicare Part D of the EGWIP plan.
Okay, and we don't have any actual employees that are involved in that. It's all just contract administration.
That's correct.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the same line, $700 million health care spend, try to trend it down below the 4% of national average. I think that's good. The national average is going way too high. But is there a plan? I mean, how are we going to get there? I mean, you manage the largest workforce in the state, probably one of the largest components across every department. How are we going to get there? I mean, we can't just manage things. We have to get control of healthcare costs. So, you know, we have just incredibly large number of components inside of that are pretty much unmanageable, right? I mean, I'm going to say it, they're out of control. That's my opinion. How are we going to wrangle that so that, and I know there's the healthcare commission coming up, they're trying to work together, but, you know, when you look at the unfunded mandate and everything else going on, the rising cost of healthcare, you know, it's going to break this state. Where, and admin is in charge of the largest health recipients, I mean, employees in the state. How we actually get there? And a larger dialogue, but.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Actually, there's a slide I have at the end that we can talk a little bit more specific, and I can jump there now or talk about it when we get there. But I do think part of that $250,000 and then the $750,000, I can just talk about in general, that I think that there's a real effort going on that has pushed us forward from the budget, the current fiscal crisis, the trend going up and up and up and nationally, not just in Alaska for healthcare, that is bringing people to the table to talk about consolidation, grouping our people together to have better buying power. But at the last slide, too, I'll talk about some specific things we have done in our healthcare plan to reduce the cost as well. Do you want me to do it now or you want me to do it later?
Let's wait until we get to
this. Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Representative Galsaki.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I did have a question about the retirement and benefit increment, the one-time increment. Two questions about it. The first one is, I'm sure you've seen what the legislative fiscal analyst says about the using the fund, and it might be an inappropriate use of the Alaska, what is it? The Comprehensive Health Insurance Fund. Can you address that?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, yes. You're talking about the $1 million and where it would come from. Yes, I'm pretty sure there's going to be a bill introduced to correct the fund source on that. It hasn't been yet, but it's coming.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. And then the second question is, under the consolidated purchasing that was just mentioned, using some of the healthcare authorities feasibility studies, that was under Senate Bill 74, and wasn't that funded was that not funded as a fiscal note? There were dozens of fiscal notes attached to it.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, that fiscal note was 1.5 years. We had money in it for one non-perm position, and we had money for a contract, which we have fulfilled. The plan has been done, the study's been done, and it's been put out there. The fiscal note expires for the person, the position, 1/4 of the way into the year. So that has now, funding has now ended for that.
So through the chair, I guess what you're saying is that when we passed Senate Bill 74, we didn't give you the money to do the report, and that's why you're coming this time for it. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. No, the reports have been done. They have been done. And the next part would be discussing any kind of implementation. The report, there's three reports, and they're available on our website. I can certainly give you the links for those. But and like Sherry said, the person who managed all that, their funding ends, and then the reports have been paid for and done.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And just for the record, that was Leslie.
Sorry. Thank you, Leslie.
We're going to the next slide.
Yep, then. Slide 14. Oh, sorry, missed slide 13, risk management. One thing I would like to point out on risk management that's not actually on the slide is I think probably Representative Kawasaki knows about this for sure. There has been an issue in Fairbanks with the airport and some fire retardant and materials, and so we probably will be coming back at some point to discuss that again. I don't have any specifics right now, but there is probably something in our future in risk management with that issue up there. Shared services of Alaska, there's $500,000 for a business transformation office. This is funded by 5% by collections and 1.5% on a 1.5% vendor fee. And what this group does is they've been doing projects around our state government where they go out and they help agencies through Kaizens and lean processes, if you're familiar with those, to take processes and make them faster, better, cheaper. And we've actually been pretty successful with those, and a lot more people want us to do those in the different departments. So that's a great project we've been doing. $138,000 for the state surplus. They move their surplus online, and we have more customers, and we sell more things, and so we need some more authority for that. And then there's a decrement of $1 million for spaces. We've been really aggressive in renegotiating leases, moving people into our state buildings, filling them up to capacity as much as we can, and negotiating and just consolidating the space and negotiating new leases for all of our properties.
And I noticed the funding shows several funding sources, the positions, but doesn't show how many are filled. If you have that information that was presented on the other slides, we'd like
to. Oh, is it missing? Oh, okay. Through the chair, yes, we'll get that to you. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on this, in the governor's budget, it shows that three employees that were part of shared services have now gone back to the governor's office. Is that because they're no longer participating, or is not all the departments participating?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, this is Leslie again. The departments are coming in waves, so not everybody is in right now. So I'm not sure about the specific three governor's staff. I can find out about that one.
And Mr. Chairman, and if we could find out who is and isn't participating, that would be, because I thought everybody was.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Yes, they will. They will all eventually. It's just we're bringing them in of waves. But we could send you the list of who's in and who's coming when.
Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to that point last year in the administration presentation, there was a calendar of what departments during which months would be going on. So I know that's readily available, but it'd be a nice update for everyone to see where we are in that, I think. Yeah, thank
through
you.
Through the chair, Representative Grant. Yes, I could definitely send that to you. Thank you.
And if you'll just send that to the committee, we'll get it to everyone.
Great. I'm on slide 15 now for Office of Information Technology. It's similar. They're also coming in waves, and we can send that to you as well as they're coming along. As you know, in the spring, the governor introduced AO 284 to consolidate information technology under the Office of Information Technology. We've rolled in about 7 departments right now for the first phase, and then we'll roll in the rest by the fiscal year, and then we'll move into phase 2. First phase is the line or commodities, email, security, storage, all the things that everybody does across the same across the enterprise. The second wave is the line of business, is that's all the proprietary stuff each department has. For example, my department has the DMV database, we have the retirement and benefits database, we have OpenPD. So everybody has something different in each department, so that's the second phase two coming in, line of business. That'll be next year.
That's true.
Yeah, Representative Gettenberg.
Thank you. So this is a big issue for me. I'm trying to push the private sector on broadband and internet, and every time I turn around, I find where I look for the state to fill its own void and not doing anything, right? Whether the results from the Broadband Commission 10 years ago or the RCA report that we pushed through the budget that came out in December, this is one of the most costly things that the state doesn't do for itself. Every time a trooper has to fly out to a village, every time somebody has to come back in, every time the state government touches a community that doesn't have broadband, we're doing things in the most expensive way we can do it. Never mind what the private sector is not doing or doing. The state admin, because you're in charge of it for our departments, has no plan. As far as I can tell, you know, the governor's administrative order to consolidate services and make them more efficient is great. But if you need to send a trooper out to someplace, or to talk to somebody, it's a plane ride for two troopers. The courts, corrections, every department, every Board of Education, everything down. It is phenomenally expensive. And nowhere, anywhere in the budget do we see a breakout of what it costs, where the costs are, because I think if you showed us that, we would be appalled, because that's the world we live in. You know, Quintillion on the Northwest Coast is great, but what about Tanana? What about Bethel? What about Dillingham? What about Ammonoch, Tanana? For the state to not have a plan to figure out how to drive down the cost with efficiencies that it should be doing. You know, and I've talked to Mr. Vida. He's great. He really knows his stuff. I don't know. He's been in there about a year. I have a lot of respect for him. But, you know, the chairman wants to break out health care costs by department. Broadband costs, somebody sitting in front of their computer trying to drive the train someplace, trying to look at something, somebody in Nome or someplace. So could you tell me what are we actually doing to get control and enhance the ability of the state government to function in places where it's just like rural electrification of the road system. We're a third world country. We're one of those countries that the president described in such rude language. That's the way I feel about it. And if I'm a little aggressive about it, because I think we are not dealing with an issue that is just vitally important for the state and our people.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, thank you. So you are correct. The Office of Information Technology, what we're working on here is the consolidation of the 17 departments and the work that they do.
across our enterprise. It is not the broadband plan for the state, and you're definitely correct about that. And I'm not a broadband expert. It isn't in our budget to do broadband for the state. It isn't. I'm not saying it's not necessarily shouldn't be in our department, but it's not in our budget. Ours is just to do the 17 department consolidations. I can get back to you on a bigger broadband plan, but it's not something I'm an expert in for the statewide broadband.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to say that if not you, who? I mean, I know it's not in your budget to do things, but you're charging departments for the uses of computers all across the state. You should be creating efficiencies for them and not just sustaining the status quo, which is incredibly expensive, right? Everybody comes in here and talks about telemedicine, teleeducation, telepsychiatry, distance delivery on everything, the courts dispensing medicines. People walk the hall trying to sell equipment, but the state doesn't have the ability to deliver those services. And it's just incredibly frustrating. So we can take it up later. That's fine.
Through the chair, if you don't mind, Sherry had a comment as well, if you don't mind.
Representative Guttenberg through the chair. A couple things that I am aware of that OIT is doing is the network is very old. And that's part of the issue. They're doing a full network refresh. We started that close to 2 years ago. And some of those rural areas, they're adding Meraki devices. I'm not IT. I can't tell you exactly what that is. But it increases the speed and the availability of the network. Other things they're doing is looking at the circuits that are out there, and they're consolidating those. Maybe you have 10 little ones, and you need one big one, and it's saving you money in order to redirect those fundings to other improvements.
Let me interrupt. If you have something that old, there's no point in joining trains. They need to go. They need to be replaced.
Well, this will be a deeper
conversation. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you. I'm on slide. This is Leslie again on slide 16. SATS and ALMR. I think Sherry talked about their funding back on the other slide. Unless you have questions on that one. Admin Services Director, slide 17. This is Sherry's department. This is our internal admin services for our department. Division of Motor Vehicles on slide 18. The Department of Motor Vehicles returns about $39 to $42 million a year to the state budget. Just depends on what kind of year they had. We still are using our private and public partnerships in the DMV. We returned about $18 million in taxes back to communities we collected on behalf of communities. And just again, I like to always brag that the wait time has gone from about 40 minutes down to about 8. We've moved a lot of things online. You can make appointments to go in so you know exactly what time your appointment is. You don't have to wait in the office, and we've done a lot to make changes. We've done all that without hiring a bunch of new people. It's been all about reorganization and fixing up the processes to make it be better.
Mr. Chair. Yep.
Reverend Guttenberg.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. DMV has been turned around, and it's something I've heard people say, criticizing other state agencies and say, well, I wish they would run like DMV. So thank you.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Guttenberg. I will have to say Marla Thompson and Amy Johnson, our director and deputy director, take all the credit. They both came in and really put a lot of effort into it, and it really shows. Thank you. Office of Public Advocacy, like I said, we have a new director there, Chad Holt. They have some money from the Mental Health Trust, $86,000.7. That's to hire a public guardian. And we have an ask in there of $1 million to hire 9 new public guardians. You may have seen a story in the paper recently. I'll just say a little bit about public guardians. The wards that we get are from the court, and they're people that nobody else is taking care of, no family, no friends, nobody else is stepping up to the plate. And so we take care of them as the court sends them to us. And we have too many for our staff. There's close to 100, depending on the time, but that they're trying to handle at one time, and that's way, way above the the national average of how many they should be taking care of. We do collect fees. Some of those people have money. Actually, they're not all indigent. And so we raised the fee. It hadn't been raised since the 80s. And we actually collected more money than we thought we would. And so, again, that fluctuates as well, just based on who's in the system and who's not. So this would allow us to hire 9 more guardians to take care of that caseload. And then also for one guardian for a child, or guardian ad litem, those are the China and OCS cases that they would take care of. And also just a reminder, the department, the division does 40% criminal. They take all the conflict cases from the public defenders, and then 60% civil is their caseload.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, congratulations on breaking another glass ceiling.
Thank you.
Yeah. So guardian ad litems, they have among the highest caseloads in the country. We've been told that in public testimony. Over 110 cases per guardian ad litem. We have not done anything substantial about that every year this comes up. I don't want to go through with this committee what these folks do other than their job is to protect the best interests of the child, the children who are in the OCS system. And I guess I would ask you to see if you could speak to the administration about taking a look at this in terms of the amended budget that will come out on February 15th. But 110 cases, not visiting these kids, not knowing the kids who are being represented in court, it's just no way to represent the best interests of a child. I know it's not your fault. You're new there. But I would like to see something done there, and if you could relay that to the governor's office to see whether children would be more healthily and safely served with a supplemental budget there.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Guerra. I will pass on that message. Thank you.
Thank you. What is a parent China representative civil?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. I believe that's the we also represent the parent sometimes in the China cases. So we represent the child and the parent too. So I think they just cut it out, separate it up.
So I'm assuming, because there's most of the time two parents, so this would be like the public defender is on one side, and then this is kind of the other attorney that has for the other parent?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes. Sometimes there's two parents, sometimes there's several kids, so so there's no conflict. Sometimes the public defender takes some of them, and we take part of the family, too.
Thank you, and one last thing. And so the guardian ad litem, can we get the breakdown of the 34? Three people, because I know obviously you can't just divide that into 110 because you only get 70, which is still too high, don't get me wrong. But I'm imagine some of that's administration and some of that's actually guardians ad litem themselves. I appreciate that.
Thank you. This is Leslie again on slide 20, the Public Defender Agency. There's an increase of, I didn't write it down. How much is it? Oh, sorry, 193.8. It's mental health funds. This is for a project up in Bethel. They've been getting the money actually for 9 years. They're doing a study along with the University of Alaska on a holistic defense model. And so that's been ongoing, and that's to continue that. And then there's a 453.5 thousand. It's we had some unrealizable money source that for Rule 39. We did not get as much money in Rule 39 based our estimates on past performance of Rule 39. It didn't come through, so this is to supplement that missing money from the Rule 39 money that we did not get.
I think we want an explanation.
And what that means? What's Rule 39? So Rule 39, thank you, Mr. Chair. Rule 39 is the payment that we get from the permanent fund dividend. And so we're on step number whatever in the list, and so we didn't get as much as we thought we would get to supplement our budget. Thanks. Sorry. I got trouble for using jargon yesterday, so I'm still doing that apparently. Page 21, the Office of Administrative Hearings. Have a couple of things I'd like to brag about there as well. They're not very visible, so I'll brag for them. They have no backlog. They implemented a new caseload management system, which helped them get rid of their backlog. They're cheaper than using attorneys. They do the job faster and cheaper than the attorneys and most attorneys. And they have a high satisfaction rate. They always do a survey, and so they're doing a great job. I just want to point that out. Page 22, the Violent Crimes Compensation Commission. Their money is federal and comes from criminal funds from the people who are incarcerated. So the criminal funds are matched with federal funds, and we just administer their budget. We don't do anything with their mission. Page 23, same thing with the Public Offices Commission. Not the same thing, but we just administer them. They've been cut in half over the last couple of years. They do as good as they can, and I think you guys are all familiar with the Public Offices Commission and what they do.
Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, and I recognize they have been cut quite a bit by legislators, in fact. Do you know how many positions are currently vacant out of those eight?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I think two. They've actually been trying to hire a programmer, and they may have actually just hired one, but they've had trouble hiring a person.
And then through the chair, some commissions and boards are paid through fees and licenses, and not that, I mean, I don't know, maybe. I'll just suggest that maybe you can recoup fees from us and from other folks, and is there a reason why that hasn't been discussed? And then the second question is, where do the claims and judgments and fines that they administer go to? I guess they just go back to the general fund.
Thanks. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, there are some things that are paid for by fees, but I actually will throw it out there. I'd love to work with somebody on a bill to revamp. I actually agree with you that there probably are a lot of things we can do. To change some things at the Public Offices Commission. And to answer your other question, the money, the fines go to the general fund. But I do think it's time to talk about fees and either increasing them or changing them in some way.
I mean, we're compensated, and some elected officials are compensated, and some are not. You know, city councils and school boards are probably a lot less. But, I mean, maybe if we're willing to fund it, we can actually get a commission that operates efficiently. You want to, you and me? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm on page 24. This is Leslie again. The Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. I mentioned Hollis French is the new chair for the next 4 years. This is all funded by industry. Again, we don't mess with them on their mission. They're a commission and on their own that way. And page 25, the Public Communications Services, new director, Molly Cabler. This is, these are general funds, but we don't administer the grants. The commission administers the grants for these.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And going to the category of public broadcasting, public radio. It looks like they're down about 902,000 since 2009. Can you give me an idea what that means in terms of to public radio stations throughout the state? Have we seen quite a few closures? Have we seen quite a few curtailed services? What does that look like?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I actually need to get back to you on that. I know they have made some cuts, and I don't have them off the top of my head. We don't do much to administer their program, so I need to get that information from them. Did you have a follow-up?
In the process of budgeting, is there an opportunity for a representative from the public radio community to advocate for their funding? Is that a normal process?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes. In the past, sometimes the subcommittee has had them come up separately and present on their own budget and talk about it. They're always willing to do that. So.
Thank you.
And, of course, there is public testimony for House finance.
Continue.
Oh, Wilson.
Oh, sorry.
No problem. So I just want to verify. So on the grants, it's just a grant. There's no parameters around it. So like just for instance, if Fairbanks decided they didn't want to do gavel to gavel any longer, there's like, you know, no, that won't affect their grant. I don't know how else to ask it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, are you asking, do we direct them on how to do that? The department?
Are there different parameters in the grant, or is you just give them the money and then they choose by who they're serving, what they might want and not want?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, they decide, the commission decides, the Public Broadcasting Commission decides.
The commission does.
Yes, they decide. If I might, I would like to point out one other thing about the satellite infrastructure, because it's been cut before and we've had to work to get it restored. This is a pretty critical piece for the whole system, and it's also part of the backbone of the emergency broadcast system. And Sherry actually has done a great job working with AT&T. They've worked with us very closely to bring down the cost as much as we can. I know sometimes people say, oh, why don't we just cut that satellite thing? But it actually is a really super important part of this whole picture, and you can't really just cut that satellite thing and not cut everything. So. Just
want
to throw that in there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know Ted Stevens was a giant advocate for this, certainly the satellite infrastructure, because just what happened the other day, mm-hmm. right, the tsunami warnings, the natural disasters in Alaska. What part of this does this play in the larger role? I mean, I know public safety is involved, your admin, but the ability to do early warning, early notification of exactly what we had Monday night or Tuesday morning, I guess, was a great example of sometimes you can leave something to languish without thinking it's important, and then all of a sudden it is desperately needed.
And through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, this is almost entirely for the satellite services, so it would impact greatly an early warning system announcement to all of the state of Alaska. The services are used within the state also, but for public broadcasting, it's imperative that they have this.
Thank you.
And that was Sherry.
That was Sherry.
Sherry, thank you.
Thanks. Page 26, miscellaneous. Leslie, professor. can only remember the page number or my name. I don't know if I can do both. Page 26, Leslie speaking. These are miscellaneous things in our office, our department, labor agreements. That's an agreement that we have with the SU Supervisors Union to provide training, Office of our commissioner, and other things within our department. Page 27, the DOA healthcare costs. This is just for our department, our overall costs, and I'll let Sherry talk a little bit more about that.
For the record, this is Sherry. Page 27. This is our look back onto our healthcare cost trends. It is the amount that the Department of Administration pays in total per PCN for healthcare contribution and for workers' comp. At the top, you'll see in 19 that was $764,800. As we bring positions in for the two initiatives that we have, well, I can expect that this cost will go up. This is based on, I believe, 1,224 PCNs in our department at that time. And at the bottom, you'll see it's split by funding source for the percentage of our budget. In 2019, our total budget is $341,218. Of that, we have the general fund and the other fund breakout, and our health care costs are 6.2% of our total.
This is Leslie again, page 28, and going back to Representative Guttenberg's question and some other things that we're doing. These are some of the things that we've done in Alaska Care over the last four years to bring down the cost of the health care to our state employees. This is just Alaska Care and the retirees, and we split it out, you can see. So this year we have a couple different initiatives that will hopefully bring down costs even further. In addition to the, I won't go over the whole list unless you have specific questions about them, but in addition to the things listed on this chart, we are constantly working in the department to think of other ways to consolidate and to share costs with others. We don't have to wait for a healthcare authority bill or plan or of any kind. We already are doing some consolidation where we can. We're also putting out, just yesterday put out a new pharmacy RFP to work for lower costs for pharmacy. We put out a travel RFP soon. We're working on a best value RFP for our whole third-party administrator. Right now it's Aetna, so that's time to come up again, and we're going to try to work on some consolidation and some cost savings there. And again, we're working on it will be actually a big project to implement the EGWIP, the Employer Group Waiver Plan, for next year, which we hope will bring in anywhere between 40 and $60 million of savings. So I'd be glad to answer questions about specifics on here, but we are doing a lot on the Alaska Care Plan to try to bring down our costs.
I noticed, or in contact with some public agencies across the state that are working on a bid basis for individual health care. And so when there's something, whether it's a surgery or whether it's just specialty things that aren't necessarily surgeries, and they are getting bids from doctors outside as well as here, and they fund the doc going to a particular doctor that is coming in the bid system. Is there anything that we are looking at as far as not universal, saying everybody's going, I mean, like Alaska Regional right now is the only one that does in South Central and everywhere else in Alaska, I think. The orthopedic surgery, it all goes through there, but it hasn't really done anything on healthcare costs compared to, you know, other places. And this individual bid system, are you familiar with it? Have we engaged in that at all?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. Are you asking, like, are we using steerage with people who are giving us, better prices? Is that what you mean? By individual bids? Yeah, we are trying to get as many people as we can under contract to offer our employees a better price, that they give us a guaranteed price so that our employees get that good price, if that's what you mean. We are trying to get, we'd love to get more and more people into our network, and that's partly what the third-party administrator does as well. They help bring people into our network. We've also partnered with, I'm going to say their name wrong, it's a healthcare coalition. It's a group of labor unions and others who have gone together to negotiate better prices as well. We've joined them on some things. Is that what you're asking me?
Well, actually, what I'm understanding is there, when somebody comes in with a problem at all, that goes out to a bid within their network and finds out what doctor, whether it's Seattle or Anchorage, say, is going to provide that service. And so then they provide airplane service, and they send the person, they're actually authorizing them to go to any of the. They're not saying you can go wherever you want. They're actually saying, okay, here's the bid. Here's where you are to go for service. And are we operating anything like that? My understanding was we might go and find out, okay, what are the prices, but you can still go anywhere you want. But you have the higher price for the lower price. Is there any price constraints if there's some of the network doctors that are providing the service quicker and cheaper than others?
I think maybe I tried a different answer. Maybe I see if I got it right this time. So that's what that travel RFP is about. If you find a doctor that's not in our network, that's outside the state, and you want to travel somewhere to go get a hip surgery somewhere, the travel RFP will allow you to do that, but it will also help you by taking care of your arrangements ahead of time. Right now it's on the employee to take care of the arrangements and try to get reimbursed later, which is sometimes a hardship for people to do, to cough up the money ahead of time for that. And so the travel RFP would help us send you to a cheaper doctor somewhere of your choosing. We wouldn't force you to do that. We wouldn't force you to go out of state, but that if you wanted to. Am I still answering your question?
Yeah,
sorry.
And I understand that process.
Mm-hmm.
And then all stuck on the employee.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm understanding is there are some of the systems that are now going to a bid basis, and so they're actually bidding with the doctor and saying, you're going to go here. And we haven't gotten to anything like that in our system. Have we evaluated anything like that? I forget the exact name, but
yeah.
On a bid basis for the services, and they were directed there. So I'll just put that out, and we can have a conversation later, but I'm just understanding that if there is someone that could.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Emily Ricci is here from our retirement benefits, and she probably understands exactly what you're saying since I clearly.
Well, I never heard of it until a week ago.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Emily Ricci, Chief Health Policy Administrator with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And if I understand, Mr. Chair, what you're describing, it's maybe a process where if someone requires a specific specialty procedure, there's some sort of bid among network providers to provide that procedure, and then they travel to receive it. And that's not something that we had contemplated before, but it's an idea that we will look into now.
Okay, and as you, I'll talk to you later, but I understand it's being done right now in the state. It's a public health, some of the programs. So.
But we're not.
I'm not just throwing out an idea. I mean, Representative Gutman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know Commissioner Davidson had talked about one of the terms is medical tourism, but I talked with a plan administrator earlier this week who has for orthopedic surgery, and we were talking about specifically about hip replacement, everybody in their plan is out of state. And when they send somebody outside to get a hip replacement, it includes the airline, the spouse, and hotel. And there's nobody in the state, and if somebody wants the procedure done in the state, they have to pay out of pocket, which is about $90,000. And they are saving a lot of money. And although you would think it hurts the state's medical community, I think it's an example of the reality of the situation. So there's a plan with thousands of members that sends everybody out of state. And it's being done now.
Thanks. I had a question on the slide just before. As we're looking at the healthcare costs, and I think some presentations have had this, some have not. I'm just looking at the one for Department of Education and Early Development, and their percent healthcare totals are about a quarter of yours, and I'm just wondering why that might be. It seemed like they'd be roughly the same if they're both represented by GGU, or maybe they have different benefits. I'm just trying to figure that out.
We'd have to look at it.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I don't know actually why theirs would be cheaper. We'll have to, OMB, I believe, prepared this for us. So we'll have to go back and ask OMB why theirs is different. I don't know.
It's looking like 5.9% in 18, going to 6.2%. You know, we've gotten charts on about 8% healthcare cost escalation, 6% GF across all of the everything from the university as being the cheapest, all the way through all the others. So, what is this representing here? You've got basically 5%, and now jumping up, you know, 5.9, and is that representing that percentage increase?
Through the chair, this is Leslie Rydell again. The biggest change is the new switch out of the OIT employees coming in and the shared services coming in, leaving the other departments and coming to our department. So our employee count is actually going to go up. So that's probably the biggest. We're going to lose a few people. Our facilities maintenance people have gone to DOT, done a little switch out as well. But in bulk, we're bringing more people into our department from the other departments. So that's a lot of that change right there.
because the health care contribution in 18 and 19, the employer contribution has been the same.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we do retirees, we also do state employees. Why is Medicaid separate? I mean, it's still travel, it's still health care, and it's in health and social services versus in administration. It just seems like we always hear a bigger pool of people, the more services that you can get. Are we not just duplicate services by having one group of people in health and social services through Medicaid versus here we have state employees and retirees over here?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. For the record, this is Emily Ricci with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. You know, both Medicaid and public employer health plans, you know, are a form of health insurance, but not all of the services that they offer are the same, and they both function in very different regulatory environments. And part of the work that one of the healthcare authority studies actually looked at was looking at the types of services that many Medicaid recipients incur versus using the Alaska Care Employee Plan as an example. And you tend to see much higher utilization of long-term care services, which is not long-term care services and some behavioral health services as an overall percentage of kind of healthcare service spend compared to more of the commercial plans. And so, you know, while they are, while the medical services that are provided are essentially the same services. You need to go see the doctor. You need to get your blood work. You need to have surgery. The way the services are reimbursed are very different. You know, we have generally a fee-for-service system with employee health plan and commercial health insurance, and then on the Medicaid side, you have kind of a very strict regulatory system, largely, I think, well, I guess set at a mix between the federal and the state level. So it's not as easy to compare the two programs as you would think. There's enough differences in terms of how they're regulated, how they're structured, and ultimately the services that they provide that it's not easy to kind of replicate one with another.
And Mr. Chairman, I just asked, a few years ago we looked into this, and the concern part, it was like, our health insurance was like wherever the more affordable, you know, if you had to go to Seattle or wherever it was, where Medicaid was all, everybody had to stay in the state. And it was kind of like if everybody had the same idea of how you were going to do it, then overall we might get more doctors. I know the programs are separate, but it's still medical, and it may be a way that we would be able to control our costs by, again, a bigger type of pool, or at least doing the same thing with both programs. Thank you.
And Representative Wilson, SB 74 required the healthcare authority, and there's four books, it's about this big on studies, but the outcome of that, when I read them, was the last thing we want to do is try and mix Medicaid into the other, because pooling those means it'll probably never happen, because there are so many regulations and so many prohibitions on even joint funding between Medicaid and other services that we would probably never get the pool set up. So there's, you know, there is a push to do pooling, but joining Medicaid pooling with our system would probably take us 10 years, and then we would, at least according to the study, we might lose more money because of the prohibitions of what federal funds could be used for than we would gain.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, I was thinking about pooling, but, you know, you've got travel, so you've got two groups doing travel. It's just even the concept. If it's good for one group to go out and find a more affordable and go that direction, it just seems like both groups should do that. And it was more of kind of like the shared services, what you can share and have one group to do. That's great. But it just seems if you have two different concepts and you're sending one group out and keep the other group in, that doesn't help the cost of health insurance or health costs altogether.
Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you know, one thing that we have been doing between the two departments is starting to, I mean, acknowledge we both manage pharmacy services, we both need clinical advice and utilize kind of medical directors. And so at different levels, in I want to say over the past 4 or 5 years, we've coordinated or tried to share those services. sometimes more cohesively than others, but we've been, you know, we've been communicating over the last year, I think, really about how internally we can share some of those services moving forward, particularly like medical directors or some of the pharmacy services.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. And if you have other questions, Thursday, January 25th at 9 a.m. We'll take two bills up at that time. That's tomorrow. HB 287, appropriation for education, student transportation, and the other bill will be HB 213, public school trust fund, and there will be public testimony on both of those bills tomorrow as well.
Easy bill.
9 o'clock.
Easy bill.
So is there any other... Seeing none, we will be adjourned at 3:35.